Hadi bakalım. Hadi bakalım.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Human Reaction Podcast. We are glad that you are here. If you are new to the show or if you've been around for a while, please do like, follow, and subscribe on YouTube, on any podcast platform that you listen on. And if you would like to become a member and get access to exclusive content like The Skiff, which is our members-only show where we talk about all the juiciest stuff, go to humanreactionpod.com to find out how.
Also, get a nice hat, like that swag you're wearing right there.
Like this one right here.
You find all of our stuff there.
That's right.
And we're joined today, again, with Kat from the Whiskey Bench Podcast. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
We just recorded the episode like 5 minutes ago, so it hasn't really been a goodbye.
Don't let him behind the curtain,
man. I'm still
here. We didn't even change clothes. We're just all ready to say, it's so weird.
If you are a small business owner looking for exponential growth, you have to connect with Adam Thune at Intellectual Patriots. He will revolutionize your business game and help you get to the next level. Adam can streamline your business practices and advertising strategies to improve your bottom line. His expertise in data engineering means he can build you the systems you need to collect and analyze market data. His mission is to provide you with invaluable insights to fuel your success. From grant writing and business proposals to digital systems integrations, even AI management, Intellectual Patriots is a one-stop shop for cutting-edge solutions. Don't wait another second. Visit intelpatriots.com to learn more. That's intelpatriots.com.
This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at RevvedUpPromo.com, that's with 2 V's and 2 P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
But yeah, David, what are we getting into today?
So yeah, so the UN has is working on deciding how much of your tax dollars are going to go from the global north to developing countries around the world to fight climate change. They're meeting right now in Azerbaijan to do so. But as a bridge topic from our last video that you probably just got done watching, we have the new EPA director has been appointed, very relevant to discussion, Lee Zeldin.
Is Z their pronoun? Because that could be, right?
No.
Caesar.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I was talking as like a really bad fantasy.
Don't all laugh like at once. Jeez.
I liked it, Joe.
Thanks. I'm trying my best over here.
Yeah, I don't know much about this guy. Does anybody have any thoughts on him? Is he good, bad, neutral?
Is
he
going to gender him?
I don't have any thoughts about Z.
So I do have a couple things just right off the Wikipedia just to get you a sense for the guy. He's a lawyer from New York, won a New York district that was somewhat controversial. Like, I was like, wow, it's got one New York, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
wait, why is that controversial?
He was like a Republican underdog.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Gotcha. And he's in Long Island, right? I think is where mm-hmm. he is in New York. And
Which is like a little more conservative than some of the other districts, right?
Long Island's actually fairly red, honestly.
Yeah, but he knocked out like an incumbent, a longstanding incumbent. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So, and then he's done a couple things on environment. We have the Fluke Fairness Act that would have changed the current system for managing fluke fishing quotas. This is for like sea fishing. Creating a regional approach to updating quotas and standard based off on geographic, scientific, and economic data. It has not passed, but he has been active in that sort of in that field. You know, it's funny that he's going for EPA. It's not exactly his specialty. He is in other committees. Is a Foreign Affairs and Financial Services Committee. So I don't really understand the pick yet. We got some more research we got to do before we really understand it. But coming back around to the UN, what's going on there? And then we're going to dive into, of course, what we see for Trump and climate, you know, discussion with Trump and the administration and then his policy. And we got Kat here who's like knows way more than the rest of us about that sort of thing, for sure.
Pressure's on.
So background. So every year, countries who've joined the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or UNFCCC,
Way too long.
Why even make it an acronym?
No, don't.
That's just ridiculous.
Just don't.
Yeah. meet to measure the progress and negotiate multilateral responses to climate change. There are 198 parties to the convention. This is a UN charter convention. And it was adopted in 1992. This is based upon the initial creation of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and to implement, you know, the policy regime globally in response to climate change. In COP, what's happening now is called COP29. It's a UN climate summit going on in Baku, Azerbaijan.
Is this the climate summit where all the billionaires and government elites fly their private jets and then lecture us on climate change? That's the same one, right?
I think that's most of them.
I think
they do that to all of them.
Yeah, that's
true. Think there's one single one where they do that.
They do dozens a year. Yeah. They just fly all over the globe in their private jets and lecture us on climate change.
So according to the Wall Street Journal, the main task of the COP29 will be to negotiate to formally set a new climate finance goal known as Collective Qualified Goal on Climate Finance.
What's the acronym there?
No, they don't have one.
The CQGCF.
I love it.
I'll help them with their branding.
So part of this that I thought that kind of drew my attention to it is the Wall Street Journal's coverage of this is interesting because I think it gives a lot of insight into what's really going on at elite institutions when they're thinking about this issue in the Trump administration. It's kind of it's what they don't say sort of thing. It's kind of what they do mention and how they cover it really gives you a lot of insight into how the elites are kind of seeing Trump and climate change and that sort of thing. I can do it. I can do it now. We have the technology. Ha ha.
Oh, I had it up already.
Oh, okay. Well, this is the Wall Street Journal one. Oh no, I didn't press the button. So. Why do you hate me?
David's learning. He's the boomer of the group.
Hey now. All right. So the title is Trump Victory Leaves China Calling the Shots at COP29 Climate Convention. And basically the framework is because Trump is likely to pull out of the UN Climate Accord that Biden rejoined after Trump pulled out, that he will, you know, basically be leaving everything in China's hand to decide the future of the climate change policy here as set by the number one other funder in this area, which is China, which really shows you what's really going on here with their priorities, right? Who decides what climate policy is who pays.
Yes.
And the other side of that is who receives.
Mm.
And a lot of this is about how China is the number one export market for green energy. They make a lot of solar panels and stuff like that using very low climate, you know, environmental standards. And the U.S. also exports solar panels at a higher climate standard, a higher standard. And how tragic it is that China is now going to be in charge of the climate response.
Well,
also, China, because they are currently designated as a receiver of the climate finance, and they just say, like, well, we'd really like them to be a giver for other countries, but they're currently on the other end of that. They actually receive benefits from the climate finance
because they're still
system.
Considered developing.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, even though they have a larger economy than us.
Yeah. I was going to say, at what point are they no longer considered developing and right. they're considered developed? It seems like they're pretty well developed by this point.
Well, I mean, if you're China, you're arguing what matters is per capita, not your total economy, right?
Oh,
because so if your per capita is lower than the United States, which it is in China.
They have a lot of peasants still.
Yeah.
And a lot of slaves.
In the countryside.
Do they count as per capita? Do they count them?
Yes.
Do the Uyghurs count?
Do the Uyghurs count? Sad.
They have to be adding that to their numbers, right?
I mean, they have to.
You got to boost those numbers up. China does better the lower per capita is in this circumstance, at least.
True. Well, I mean considering funds. That it's been purported, and I don't know if it's been substantiated or not, that they use slave labor to build their solar panels, which is why they're so low cost, part of the reason. It's a little bit of a question mark.
Seems like
for
a
me.
Good policy decision right there. It's cheap.
It's good economic policy decision, perhaps. Yeah, maybe.
So, thank you for that downer, Joe.
We ever think about instituting something like that?
And there's another one. Is like the underlying like fawningness for totalitarianism here. And I read this quote, Trump's victory has underscored what many countries already believed, that America's internal political divisions mean it can't reliably lead global climate change policy, diplomacy, sorry. If Trump follows through on withdrawal, it would be the third time this century that a Republican president has pulled the U.S. out of a major international climate agreement. So the real problem is that people in America can elect leaders who don't agree with climate change. In China, that's not a problem.
No, they can't
they
elect
can
leaders.
They can care about climate change all day.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I mean, is it so much that the Republicans don't believe climate change? I mean, I know that that is maybe sort of broadly the idea, but you don't even have to disagree with the idea that climate change is occurring per se to disagree with the way the policy is enacted globally. And I mean, isn't there a lot of disparity, Kat, between, like, you know, the burden that the U.S. carries and like the work that the U.S. has done to be such a clean economy versus a country like China, which obviously they have a long way to go on that front. And they're like by far the world's largest polluter, aren't they?
Yeah, for sure. And I think also there's some like basic facts that get ignored when we talk about this. One, the most effective way the U.S. has lowered emissions is through deploying natural gas and ramping up our use of natural gas. Now, the left ignores that fact because they're against all fossil fuels, and there's a motivation there that goes beyond environmental concerns. But in China, yes, they are producing, they kind of have a lead, or not kind of, they do have a lead on producing green energy technology like solar panels. And they've adopted a lot of electric cars, for example, within, they export them, but also within the nation themselves. Now, one of the facts that's overlooked is that China actually, they have to import oil, but they have a lot of coal deposits. They run their country largely on coal. They run their electrical grid on coal. So it's actually really cheap and cost effective for them to have electric vehicles that can be charged on a grid run on coal than it is to be importing oil and refining it and turning it into gasoline for cars. So like their motivation for adopting green technology isn't necessarily about improving the environment. It's a basic economic calculation for them. And all of that is sort of ignored in how we talk about these things. I also think that, of course, this Wall Street Journal article, they have an agenda. The way they've presented this is Republicans don't care about the environment. Trump's going to be really bad on climate change, and sort of subtly implying that the Biden administration was good on climate change. And yes, they passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which they named it that to trick people into voting for it and thinking it was going to reduce inflation. It was a bunch of spending. It did not, of course, reduce inflation. And then when they realize, oh, shit, we didn't brand it correctly, and nobody realizes that this was actually the biggest climate spending bill, and we want to get credit for that, their, you know, their PR went into overdrive trying to correct that marketing error. But what are their real, what were really the climate policies of the Biden administration? It was subsidizing preferred industries. It was subsidizing wind and solar companies. How does that reduce global emissions?
Great question.
It doesn't. It really doesn't. I mean, to a degree that's like, you can't even measure it. So the idea that like, or the EPA's sort of backdoor mandate where they updated their regulations that basically would force auto manufacturers in the U.S. to produce by like 2035, they'd be producing nearly, I think like 50% of the cars that they sell would have to be electric in order to meet the emission standards set out by the EPA. So that was like a backdoor EV mandate. None of these things actually, even if we were to fully, every single car on the road in the U.S. was an electric vehicle, it would have such a minuscule impact on global emissions that subsidizing these industries does nothing other than transfer money from the taxpayer to a corporation. It doesn't actually improve the environment.
So you're saying the climate change agenda is a grift?
Yeah, yes. Which I'm sure is not, you know, an unheard of thing here. But yeah, so it's like, so, I mean, and also the other thing too, the Paris Climate Accord and whatever COP29 is going to come up with to replace it, these are non-binding agreements. So like nobody's, they can make whatever declaration they want about how much money China and the US is going to transfer to, you know, the global South. None of it's binding. And again, imposing green energy mandates or subsidizing green energy transition on impoverished countries that haven't already evolved from using, you know, like biomass, you're then forcing them to have an unstable grid, right? Like you need baseload energy in order to actually basically subsidize green technologies. And trying to get the Global South to leapfrog that process isn't going to work, and it hasn't worked. So a lot of this stuff is just, it's posturing, it's talking points, it's, you know, kind of, it's PR. It doesn't have a tangible impact on the environment.
Wasn't the U.S., even though they dropped out of the Paris Climate Accords, weren't we like the only country that was actually in accordance to it?
Like, we're one of the few ones that made our early goals for it. There have been other countries that have. A lot of them are countries in Africa. Let me see here. I have a brief list here. Nigeria, Ethiopia, Morocco, Kenya, and Costa Rica and Nepal are aligned with the 1.5 degrees Celsius goal using their fair share approach. And Norway is the only other one at 2 degrees Celsius. But the early goals from during the Trump administration, yeah, America was one of the few ones that actually accomplished it. And that was mostly because of the fracking revolution and the switch to natural gas.
Well, isn't that kind of what this guy's implying in the article? Like, a Republican president has dropped out of three global climate things,
yeah,
even though
that's
we
what
were.
Wants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter that we were in accordance with it. It's just, we dropped out of it, so that's going to be his talking point.
Yeah, it's important to understand. So the Paris Climate Agreement, basically what it says is that you have this goal that your country is supposed to meet, and there are like localized factors for it, right? So if your country doesn't have a lot of natural gas, you know, that's another expectation. Everyone's supposed to get on wind and solar panels, of course, right? That's what the subsidies are for. But it does take into account, hey, well, you did reduce. So countries are technically acknowledged for their contribution by switching to natural gas. In that sense, if another country, such as Russia, for example, were running on more natural gas, they're actually signed on for this as well. And they're still part of the Paris Climate Accords.
It can't even be said that green energy we know is like vastly more expensive overall than fossil fuels. Isn't that correct? I mean, when you consider like the lifespan of, say, a solar panel or like a wind turbine, like the wind turbines are done in like 10 years. They decay rather quickly. Solar panels,
like 20 years. Yeah.
The lifespan's like maybe 30. Is that right?
I think the average is like 25.
It's just like wind turbine graveyards now that we have.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't have a way to recycle them.
Yeah.
Plus the whales.
It creates an unbelievable.
The whales hate them. I want to be a whale psychologist.
That was such a weird line. I loved it.
That was a weird
line. I loved it. It was so good.
Why do they do it? They just kill themselves.
That's
very
right.
Sad.
But
the left had a heyday with that one. I remember.
Yeah.
The left should be having
true.
A heyday with the whales.
It's fascinating. Right. It's an interesting question. I have no. What's the research on that? Is there any? Like, what is the commonly understood reason why there might be a negative? I mean, birds make sense, right?
Sure.
It's a big thing flinging through the air, and birds fly through the air. But why would offshore wind produce the effect on whales?
I think my understanding is that what's actually like the infrastructure itself that's actually in the ocean is emits like subtle sound, and that screws up whale sonar.
Whoa.
And I'm not obviously an expert on that, but like I think what it's doing is it's basically like confusing the whales and their ability to communicate and navigate. Mm. And it's, I think it's leading them to like, I want to say run aground.
That's maybe not
the right way to phrase it.
Ashore?
I mean, yeah, that's right. You know, so...
they're beaching themselves?
Yeah, it's yeah. I think that's my understanding. And it's another one of these things, just like with, you know, the BLM overlooking endangered species concerns to green light solar development in, you know, the California desert.
That's Bureau of Land Management people. Not,
oh,
not
yeah.
Black
sorry.
Lives Matter. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Black Lives Matter is
confusing.
Not in charge.
Everything's weird after 2020.
I know. The Bureau of Land Management had to change all their like social handles during 2020 because they were like, this doesn't make sense. It's kind of funny. Yeah.
So what were you saying?
Like, blowing them up, you know, online.
It's like how
fuck
could you?
Yeah.
Like, we're just trying to manage land.
Yeah. But the whale thing goes in line with kind of all of these other environmental concerns that just get pushed to the wayside in the name of climate change. And again, our only solution is to subsidize industries to implement a technology that's completely inefficient and cannot function on its own without the fossil fuel baseload energy subsidizing it. So like, how is that a long-term solution to climate change? Like, it's total grift, as you say, and it's not sustainable in the long run, like at all.
But that's the whole point.
for people just to get rich in the short term?
No, that it's sustainable. Well, I mean, maybe the getting rich is. Yeah.
I think that's more the incidental point, actually. Right.
Their supposed goal is sustainability.
Right.
Which
right.
always never made a lot of sense to me as a goal, but still, like, the whole idea is that eventually you're 100% green or clean,
right. Yeah,
or
yeah.
those kind of like buzzwords that actually don't make any sense.
Yeah.
How is that not penetrating the field of science, of climate science, and these supposed scientifically orientated disciplines that, hey, we have no theory of actually how to get there, right? Like, that seems like the first thing that they would, these are the sort of people that you would rely on to say, hey, our ends don't reach our means. How do we actually get there? We actually need a plan.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, unfortunately, like, much of scientific research is corrupted by grant funding. Mm-hmm. And also, I think, just like social pressure too. It's really taboo to go against kind of the consensus party line on this issue. I do think increasingly, here's a funny little thing. And it's like when economics rears its head and forces people to face reality, like, you know, the truth emerges pretty quickly. So, you know, the AI revolution requires huge amounts of power to fund their data centers. And, you know, I don't understand how all that works, but whatever, it requires a lot of power. And so now these big companies that are worth billions of dollars and, you know, are convinced us all that AI is the future, they are looking at having literally their own like nuclear reactors to power their data centers.
Wow.
And everyone seems to be totally on board with that. All of a sudden, all the opposition to nuclear energy has sort of just dissipated, and everyone's, the left, is cool with this.
I mean, you can't go without your ChatGPT.
Right.
How would you ever do that?
Yeah, that's really important.
How would you write
it? Also, a lot of these people were the climate funders in a lot of ways, too, like the Silicon Valley people.
That's a great
prior
point.
To...
realizing
AI revolution happening too, yeah. And now there's begun to be a bit of a shift there, right?
Yeah.
So this is kind of interesting incentives that exist.
Yeah. Since the Obama administration set up their nuclear power special committee sort of thing, and they've been actually pursuing an agenda publicly funded to try to revive nuclear since the Obama administration, I've seen a lot more liberals and progressives start moving in a more friendly direction towards nuclear power. Bill Gates funding a lot of the research and a lot of the other side of that as well, advocacy for nuclear power. I know that makes it bad, but...
I was for nuclear until
now
you said that.
Nuclear.
Now I hate it. You just ruined it for me. I'm sorry.
That's why he doesn't use Windows, folks. That's really what it is. It has nothing to do with Mac being better at video editing. It's just Bill Gates.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you meant like Windows.
Yeah, I was like, it took me a second.
Look out Windows. Like,
because you're afraid of nuclear?
Yeah. Kyle, obviously.
Microsoft.
I hide myself in a nuclear fallout shelter.
I was looking up about whales and wind turbines.
Welcome back.
I did find some information there.
I must be a whale psychologist, folks.
Yeah. Whale psychiatry, next big thing.
Whale Prozac.
But I think it's a... Personally, I've always felt like nuclear was the best way to go, especially smaller nuclear reactors. I really like the French model on this. It's one of the few things they do well. They build very small nuclear reactors that are like more modular, and they expand them on the margin on the grid rather than what the United States does, which is like, let's build one that's 6 football fields wide and one giant one, and we'll spend $1 trillion on it.
And if it fails, everyone dies.
Yeah.
And all our friends get the contracts.
Exactly. Well, and this is part of the challenge. The EPA has made it nearly impossible for a long time. That's what this Obama Nuclear Energy Special Commission was supposed to do, was like realign the EPA's assessment of nuclear energy with the new nuclear energy plants and what was available that were safer and more effective and could be smaller and more efficient.
Didn't France start to begin toning down a lot of their nuclear capabilities?
I was
going to
ask the same thing.
Didn't that happen? Did they ramp it back up again? Or am I making... Is that just like a story?
No,
we briefly talked about that on one of the episodes fairly recently.
Yeah, there's been some disincentives for France to go both ways, but obviously...
That tracks.
The best way to...
I was going to say that too.
I'm sorry.
I almost got it wrong with me today. Look, I was going to chime in on the French models part, and you're like, I'm a fan of French the French model on this. I was like, I bet you are. Don't tell Jessica.
They go both ways.
Anyway, sorry, David. You're trying to make a very good point.
No, I'm done now. I don't know. I totally lost it.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. I'll see you later.
Which way are they going? Yeah, I mean, obviously you have the international pressure is for them to stick with that, right? Because it's base load. Meaning, what base load means, for those who don't know, is it's consistent energy on demand. You don't have to worry about whether or not it's sunny out, whether or not the wind is blowing. And so it's regardless of the weather. It takes up a smaller footprint, even though nuclear power plants can be very large. The footprint trade-off is enormous, especially compared to solar. Because, I mean, France is kind of a cloudy country. But even compared to solar, because the footprint, the actual geographic area is acres and acres and acres versus, you know, a fairly large building.
And yeah. The power density you're getting out of that small acreage from nuclear versus what the equivalent from solar would be like an astronomical amount of land mass.
Oh, yeah. Well, and also, like, what's the longevity of a nuclear plant versus a field of solar panels?
Right.
Especially if they're motorized to track the sun and all that stuff. I mean, you got so many moving parts there, and
well, and that's another tell on sort of the climate activist community. It's a tell of how serious they really are. They've been opposed to nuclear for a very long time, and truly, like up until very recently, and with kind of the AI incentive to adopt nuclear, and if they really were concerned about emissions and anthropogenic climate change, that is obviously the first alternative energy source you would go to. And then they haven't done that. So, you know, I think it's hard to take these people seriously.
Well, what is going on there if they're unwilling to accept that? Like, why are they unwilling to accept it? Or is it just different motivations?
I think the activist class there's a significant portion of not necessarily the activist class that has power, but the ones that are, you know, kind of online and gluing themselves to Mona Lisa's and stuff. They're fundamentally anti-human. They just are. I think that's a pretty well established fact at this point.
It's just that anti-natalist strand is just,
I really think so. And I think they're anti the West, they're anti-Western civilization, they're anti-capitalism and free markets. Like, I think that this is a pet project tool to destabilize the system that we currently live under.
With AI?
No, just like the activist and environmental climate class.
Yeah, they're not in favor of the AI nuclear.
Yeah, no, they don't like that.
I thought you were saying they were. Okay, I was confused.
No, but the serious, like, influencers with money who fund and push the climate agenda, those people are okay with nuclear being used for AI because they're in the world of real money and they recognize that that's necessary.
They're probably invested in nuclear and invested in AI startups.
And I think so the activist class kind of has this more sinister motivation, in my opinion. And I think the serious moneymakers who are influencing policy and driving this national conversation, they just have a financial interest in getting the government handout for the companies that they're invested in. And so, I mean, maybe I'm too cynical, but I don't really think that there's genuine environmental concern by a lot of the people that are pushing this agenda.
So what, do they just abandon it when it kind of comes to light within the public consciousness that what has been branded sustainable green energy, you know, wind and solar mostly, like, aren't actually feasible? They just kind of brush that under the rug and prop up their next thing.
That's just coal industry propaganda, Joe.
Yeah.
No, what you do is you confuse people. That'll never come to light, because what you do is you have a prior commitment that you've staked your life on, that you've orientated your ontology, your whole sense of self on, moral views about nature and about what it means to be a conscious being. That deep down, that's where this stuff starts, and then it expresses itself in climate activism. So when you hear the opposition, right, or when you hear that it's not going to work, right, it's just like, that's just, you're just disinformation, right? You're just raining on the parade.
So you think the propaganda machine is so effective and it's been laid on so thick for so long that it's not going to be possible for a certain subset of people to ever realize that green energy is kind of a farce.
Well, it's even the words we use. We use the word green. We use the word clean. Like, our whole lexicon is built around a view of the world that assumes that these things are clean and good and nature, right?
When really green equals morality, like it's right. like a it's a religious yeah. principle.
It's, you know? it's a Maya cult. It's yeah. a Gaia cult, right? It's like it's yeah. meant to worship itself. The highest good is nature. Not the highest good is virtue. Not the highest good is
mankind.
Virtue, or, you know, any of those. It's that.
And man, and in that sort of ideological perspective, man in the humankind sense is separate from nature.
Yeah.
Right. They don't view us as a part of nature. They view us as something
which is such like a Genesis,
nature.
The fall of man being yeah. separate. Well, it's such yeah. a like a biblical type of thing right. to be using for a bunch of atheists.
Well,
you know?
I think it's actually, it's like a Gnostic thing. It's like there's this whole idea in Gnosticism. They have this thing called the Demiurge, which actually yeah. is the thing that's really controlling the world. And it's actually an evil God that made the world and made all the suffering. That man is actually the Demiurge. Right, it's the we are the ones who create suffering because we're conscious of suffering. All the animals, they're just innocent, but we're the ones who actually make real suffering.
We're the ones hurting the animals. We're the bad guys. We're the villains in the situation. So yeah. you got to take out the villains.
That's
something that's like the subconscious, and I think what Kat's kind of getting at is there's like urge to kind of commit suicide for humanity that exists there.
Yeah.
Within them.
Oh yeah.
Now I think again, maybe I'm too cynical, but I think like the lemmings. That again are the activist class. They're motivated by what you guys just described.
Yeah,
I think the people that are really influencing policy and making money off of this—that's not their motivation. They're serious people. I think there is now an industry built up around climate change that it makes a lot of people a lot of money, and that's going to be really hard to dismantle. No matter how much we—I mean, the facts are out there. We can prove that. Green energy isn't really green. It's not actually good for the environment, or that it's totally inefficient and it's a pipe dream to think that we're going to, you know, run in a full economy off of it. So I think it's the financial incentive there that really has to be dismantled in order for this to kind of go away.
There's also probably like fifth gen warfare that's going on with it too. Like you could imagine, you know, if you're a foreign entity and, or you're trying to create some havoc over the course of generations of a country, of the empire, you plant some mind viruses into the society, get it infiltrated and have it spread throughout academia, and then you have generations that adopt the Gaia cult, right? And then that turns into what it's becoming. And then the institutions get filled, and a bunch of them are just useful idiots for this mind virus that's being spread.
Right. Yeah. And I think so we've seen that I mean, that's happening here in the US, but we've seen that really in kind of a stark example play out in Europe. And I'll just preface this with, I don't think we should go to war with Russia. So don't misinterpret what I'm saying here. But it's kind yeah. of well established that Russia is behind a lot of the propaganda, or at least they've taken the opportunity to exploit the climate movement in Europe. And they do that by supporting the climate movement, because the more Germany shuts down all their nuclear plants and refuses to use their coal and natural gas resources, they then are dependent on importing energy from Russia. And that's exactly how it's played out. And now
they take out the pipeline.
And then we take out the pipeline.
I'm about to say, you got me. Yeah, you
I mean,
me
it's,
it.
I mean,
I saw it in your eyes. I was like, I got to get to it.
It's true though. You know, so I think, yeah, like we've totally seen this yeah. movement be exploited in kind of like a war game scenario. And honestly, that's what China's doing too.
Yeah.
To think that China is going to be the leader in or like any promises they make on climate has anything, their top priority, frankly, now, again, I don't want to go to war with China, but I'm not a fan of China, the government. They're entirely motivated on what's going to be best for growing their economy and, you know, for national prosperity, as it should be, right? Like that is what a national leader should be focused on.
Yeah.
But so again, maybe I'm too cynical, but I think any of their climate promises, that's just kind of the posturing that they have to do to play on the global stage. And that article that you shared, David, talks about how, you know, with their Belt and Road Initiative, they've been, you know, influencing climate policy in the global South. That's just a way to manipulate countries into, you know, being in a beneficial relationship with them where they benefit. And those countries are, I mean, from what we've seen, they get exploited for their natural resources or their cheap labor.
Yeah.
And, you know,
For those that might not be familiar with the Belt and Road Initiative, can you just briefly describe that?
Sure. And it's actually, they kind of have been winding it down in recent years because it's sort of been a failure. But they, for a long time, for like a decade plus, China was investing in developing nations, largely throughout the global south, and doing things like building a new airport in Bangladesh. And then they have, you know, or maybe the Congo is a better example. And then they have... in exchange for that, and frankly, they often end up paying off government officials, and then they can rape the country for its natural resources and use slave labor in the process.
It's often oriented around setting them up for importing Chinese goods as well. It's a mercantilist, you know, policy. What you do is you go into a country, get them. The IMF does this too, to be clear, and this is being accused of American foreign policy and other mercantilist influenced business government merger kind of operations where you go into a country, get them onto a where they owe you, and then in order to repay, you get them on regimes and you say, hey, it would be great if you hosted our black site now because you owe us all this money. Or you say, hey, it would be great if we could let us get access to this permit so that we can bring in our Chinese mining company here. Those are the sorts of things that people are citing to. Some of this is normal business relations. Others are very corrupt, horrifying, you know, examples of exploitation of a smaller, weaker country and, you know, political corruption within that country. So it ranges, right? I mean, some of these things you can, and there are apologists for this on the other side who say, no, a lot of this is actually the same economic development that the West does. It just doesn't do it with Western guilt associated with it. Like, hey, you need to make sure you allow trans rights and stuff like that that go along with it. I mean, there's another side to that as well. That said, it is not necessarily a good thing. It's mercantilist, so I oppose it on principle, but that's the idea.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is actually happening, but on the whole climate change, green energy side of things, it would make a lot of sense if I were China and I said, hey, you know, South American country, let us come in and build a power plant and reinforce your grid, and then you just have to buy all of our electric cars and drive them here and use our power and, you know, stimulate our economy. That would seem like a pretty decent business decision.
And to be clear, American policy elites don't like it because it's exploitative. They don't like it because China's doing it and they're not.
Right.
Yeah, totally.
That makes sense.
That's fair.
Totally. But the mythology is we don't like it because it's exploitative. Right.
Like,
right.
People get on their high horse, like, but the Chi-Coms are doing is like, well, that's our policy. They're copying us.
Right.
Yeah. Why isn't it working? Why are they winding it down?
I think because they haven't. There have been, I think, plenty of instances where like the infrastructure actually sucks and fails, or
because it's made in China.
Yeah. I think broadly the issue is that the countries that they're trying to form these relationships with, after, you know, this has been implemented for 5+ years, realize that they're getting the, you know, raw end of this deal, and they don't actually swear allegiance to China. And so I think that's where it's failed.
I did pull up a map, Bennett, of all the countries that the Belt and Road Initiative is touching here. But you can kind of see the general footprint that exists there, right? And like Kat said, a lot of the global south, South America is filled. I believe the bridge at the Darien Gap.
Yes.
I think that was Belt and Road Initiative.
Yes,
right?
Though they're currently building it. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, it's Chinese money.
That seems like fifth-gen warfare stuff.
There's no goods that go through the... I mean, the Darien Gap, until this migration crisis, was not like a regularly trafficked route. Like, there's not normal commerce going through the Darien Gap. It's this like incredibly dangerous, dense jungle that's basically undeveloped. And yeah, so, and the Chinese Communist Party is building infrastructure there. Just in the last few years. Why? That's a great question. Yeah, totally.
Just asking questions.
Just asking questions.
Just asking questions.
It would never be that they wanted to flood the United States with migrants. That would not. That would not. They would never do that.
I don't know. I would never. Some people are saying it.
I would never say it. Some people are saying it. Oh, goodness.
One last thought just on the energy piece, too. Mm-hmm. What we have seen from the greater adoption of EVs in the U.S., at least, it hasn't led to a reduction in fossil fuel use per individual. They're just now what we've concluded is that people use more energy because of alternative energy sources. They're not switching from using fossil fuel energy to, you know, green energy. With more green energy on the grid, they're just using more energy in total. So again, it's not actually reducing energy consumption and therefore indirectly reducing emissions. It's just expanding the base of energy that is used.
And that would be, that's a, you would guess that.
Right.
You know, before, with basic economics, you would guess that what you would see, because human demand is an infinite curve, mm-hmm. you would see a request for more abundance as you expand the potential, right? So, for example, if you introduce a Tesla into someone's car, they might drive more daily, right? Because it's cheaper at that point to drive. So they drive more daily, and therefore they drop them off the energy grid. They might be spending less money as an individual, but we're not necessarily putting out less carbon at that point.
Right. And most people don't only own an electric vehicle. It's usually their second car is what we've seen too. So like,
well, you want to be on going on a road trip, right?
You practically need exactly. Right. Yeah, totally.
Much less if the grid goes down and you don't have a solar panel to charge your Tesla, you're in a lot of trouble.
Right. Or a gas generator.
That's my favorite.
Setup. I bought one before the
truck with the gas generator in the back.
Or them wanting to make like electric tanks.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God. Oh,
that's terrible, that, right?
Hey, the torque might be nice in some circumstances.
Yeah, it's just, a huge you might deal. Want to be able to go some distance on that bad boy.
You don't want to run out of battery mid-battle.
Wasn't there a Greta parody thing about making more...
Yeah, we played that. Yeah. We played that Greta parody where she's talking about like the glorious electric like artillery and things like that.
Yeah.
I think it was like...
How dare you!
I'm really scared of electric planes. I think that sounds really scary. Like getting on a commercial flight powered by batteries. Like they won't let you take your cell phone on there because it might explode. And they're just going to power these things with them?
Fly it through the sky.
Come on. It's ridiculous.
I think any of this technology, I don't think... one frustrating thing with the conversation around this stuff, and I don't mean our conversation, but just in general, is people kind of go into these camps of like, I hate electric vehicles, or I love electric vehicles. And that's not the point. The point, like, if people want to innovate and use private capital to invest and develop new technologies, have at it. But when the government mandates or creates these little backdoor incentives, like what they did with, you know, what the EPA's emission standards did to auto manufacturers, that's where there's an issue, because they're trying to force a technology that is not ready to be mainlined, and they're trying to force it into adoption. And it has huge disruptions for the economy and for, you know.
And the grid can't handle it.
And the grid can't handle it.
It's like these things need to be transitions, and we'll probably end up in a hybrid economy when it comes to these things, where it's like there'll be some gas, there'll be some electric, depends on what you need. And electric will get better over time. But right now they're kind of not at the point where they need to be for everybody to just have them. You know, like that'll be kind of where we're sitting at.
California asked people to stop charging their cars for a little bit because their grid
could brown out. Yeah, because of brownouts.
And it was like it was the week after they mentioned, we're going to transition to like 100% electric cars by 2035. The timing could not have been
And then we all got alerts. And I still have I'm from California. I still have a Bay Area phone number, and I got those alerts. Like everybody got a text message being like, please like reduce your electrical use during this time, because it was, you know, wildfire season and surge on the grid.
So I want to introduce an alternative mental model, which is if you're trying to budget out energy by reducing consumption, what you're going to do is you're curbing the ways that energy expenditure solve human needs. That's why people don't like it. That's what the economy exists to do, is to solve problems for people. I need to get groceries. I need to get in my car and get to the groceries. How I get there, well, all the things that chain in between there, if I can't because I'm suffering a brownout and my Tesla's not charged, that's like a interruption of human needs that actually has real penalties on real people. That's why forcing it is a problem. And secondary to that, like the alternative vision to that is energy abundance, where we have so much energy, human needs can be solved cheaply, and therefore you live a more prosperous life. That's the inside of economics, that things being cheaper by dollar isn't as important as having the abundance of it, the increase of supply, so that you can solve your needs on the margin as cheaply as you can. Yeah. And that's like the difference in mental model that I wish was more prevalent amongst the political class, where they said, hey, no, I'm worried about climate change, whatever, but we need energy abundance. And this isn't going to get us there.
And it's just that anti-human streak that runs through that class that kind of prevents them from thinking that way.
Well, it's also a bunch of false mental models, a bunch of Malthusianism, like, oh, we're going to run out of resources. Peak oil. When I was in college, peak oil was still a thing. Like they were still talking. Yeah. It was debunked then, but all the academics were still talking about how we're going to run out of oil. It's like getting into the dinghy in the English Channel and be like, I'm going to run into France. It's like it's not going to happen. Like, it's very unlikely, guys. Yeah.
That's a great metaphor. I like that.
That was Matt Ridley. He gave that metaphor.
I think also, like, if our politicians were really serious about reducing emissions, they would be trying to convince the public to get on board with a carbon tax. That's really the only way to reduce consumption, if we're concerned about the demand side of this equation. That's the only way to do it. Subsidizing industries to create alternative energy only, that just creates more energy consumption. That's not going to get us at reducing emissions. If we really want to reduce energy consumption, we should put a tax on it. Mm. I'm not for that, by the way, if that's really their goal, that's what they should be focused on. Likewise, if they really want to transition us to a different alternative energy source, they should be focused on nuclear. Like, and they don't consider either one of those things, and that's why I don't take them seriously.
The carbon tax was getting floated out a bunch a while ago. It seems to have lost steam, because I actually remember when I was in college, I had some former congressman contact me about trying to get a bunch of students together to discuss the ideas of a carbon tax and would this be a good Republican solution to things. And I talked with his staff. I wasn't until I was in the meeting when he proposed the idea, but I was like, I don't know, you're talking to a bunch of libertarians here. You're proposing a tax, man?
Like,
this is not gonna fly. This is like 9 years ago, maybe 10 years ago.
Kamala Harris ran on a $10 trillion climate change plan that included a climate pollution fee. Mm. It's not a tax, it's a fee. So,
oh, I mean, right.
It's different.
So we'll okay, all feel right? better about that.
Good branding.
Oh, yeah, man.
I mean, it's politically untenable, so like it's never going to happen.
Did you hear about that this year? That in 2019, she ran on that? No.
No, of course not.
Well, of course, because it's tremendously unpopular.
Yeah. Right? Her values hadn't changed, though. Just every single policy stance she stood for. She
AI was just, is kind of a fancy thing. It's, first of all, it's two layers.
Oh, God. Did you guys see the clip where she was touring some like chip manufacturing plant or something, and she wanted to touch stuff, and they told her, like, the guide was like, oh, no, like, don't touch anything. Everything's really sharp and blah, 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 and like fragile. And then she says, and shiny. Jesus Christ.
I'm kind of retarded.
I'm going to say, I'm going to miss the memes from this era.
Oh, man.
What happens
to Kamala? I know, does she just fade into the background?
I think she has to, right?
Like, she just disappears, right?
Because the left is going to, they didn't want to take her on.
I can't see her.
She's the greatest thing ever.
She's the next Joan Carroll.
Right.
She's going to tour around.
Yeah, you're right.
Salty, talking right. about the environment now.
I don't know. I think she'll pick her pet project.
The Russians stole the election. Yeah. She's going to write a book.
I think she becomes governor of California once Newsom starts running. I'm not even kidding.
Maybe.
Oh, I don't know. California's trending more red.
Yeah.
That's true. That might actually help them trend more red.
I think she runs.
She ran.
Totally.
Or just more of an exodus.
True.
So what do we see out of the Trump administration for climate policy, that or energy policy we haven't otherwise seen? Any promises, any of that sort of thing? Obviously, the liquid gold, you know. And,
don't touch my liquid gold.
We're not going to let RFK touch it.
Anwar would probably be another major one. I mean, he's touted Anwar as like a huge success that obviously got shut down. And then is the Canadian pipeline come through North Dakota?
Keystone.
I'm forgetting right now. Keystone, is that still tenable at this point, or what's on the table for that?
Actually, thoughts? I don't know if it is.
I thought
not,
I
if it's not
I don't remember who said it, but I thought I heard someone saying that was going to be back on the table now.
Like, I think Trump did.
Maybe.
I know Anwar for sure, but I don't know about Keystone. It depends.
I thought he specifically said Keystone.
Yeah, I remember an interview him talking about the Keystone in recent months.
Was that Rogan?
No, it was before that.
On Rogan is when he talked about Anwar.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is in Alaska, which is an enormous.
How much of that is dependent on the Canadians, though? And that might not be acceptable in a Trudeau government.
I don't know. Canadians are actually pretty good at natural resource exploitation in general, like forests, mines, stuff like that. Like, they still have a lot of natural resources.
I don't know.
You should know. That's your people.
If you've seen the GDP since Trudeau took office, it's just like they were on par with GDP with America. And then as soon as Trump or Trudeau took office, it's just downhill.
Yikes.
We'll have to see in the 2025 elections where that probably turns out.
Yeah.
They don't do their elections in even numbered years.
Losers. The prime minister gets to call the elections randomly sometimes.
Right?
What?
It's really, I don't understand how their elections work. I've just been following the polls of if the elections were held today, how many seat changes would happen. And we're talking a 100 seat swing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's just if it was held today, but the election's probably not going to be held till like October next year.
Hmm. How many seats do they have? Like 917?
Yeah, we're talking like NDP losing like 120 seats.
I was going to say, it's like a parliament system, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Wild. I mean, I have to think, and we haven't really heard like a ton about this yet post-election, but energy policy has to be like so top of the list for the Trump administration. I mean, if you think about inflation and the drivers of inflation, like obviously money printing has a tremendous amount to do with it. There's only so many ways and only so quickly that you can possibly correct for that. But like energy cost contributes to the cost of every good that we all buy for all the reasons. So like, don't you think that's kind of an important thing for them to tackle?
Yeah, I would just make the case a little bit different. The president can't really do anything about interest rates. He can apply indirect pressure, but the Fed, as right. we saw, as Powell made clear, he has no ability to decide the end of his tenure.
He can recommend.
He can recommend, but he can, yeah, and he can pick from their pre-select list of people. The other side of that, but I do think that's why we'll see a lot of federal action on things like energy prices, because it's something that's most within the domain, because the president's been empowered with this executive order authority on so many different things that are critical for that, such as across the Bakken, across, you know, ANWR and all these other permitting processes where the federal government can decide by executive order whether or not to move forward based upon ideology, not based upon anything real.
I think also not just in the environmental space, but on the inflation point, you know, the Fed, I think, acted too slowly and were in the team transitory camp for far too long, probably for political reasons. But they eventually, you know, applied the tools that they could to try to reduce inflation. But they were in some way that effort was handicapped by the fiscal policy that did nothing to try to rein in inflation. Right. So right. I think like that's where the Trump administration can play a role mm-hmm. with fighting inflation is by, yeah, exploiting energy resources because that's an input into every product, you know, that we consume. And I think even like, I mean, economic growth is helpful, of course, and balancing our budget is helpful as well for like the long term health. So I think, you know.
Wait, are you telling me the Inflation Reduction Act reduce inflation?
No, that was the most consequential climate.
It was the climate bill.
Of all time. Right.
Well, yeah. And the Fed right now is on track for interest rate reductions, and that's probably going to end up having an effect as well.
It's
going to be a boom bust cycle, but like, and then they'll jack it back up in 2 years ago, and we'll be going through the same 4 year cycle that we're always going in. But mm-hmm.
did they just make a quarter point?
Yeah.
Cut.
Yeah.
Like right after the election, right?
Larger than expected.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right about the fiscal policy side. And to be clear on that, that means the federal budget deficit means printing an extra $1 trillion to $2 trillion every year, right? In a 14 trillion, what's our current GDP? 21 trillion or something like that annual?
Some big number.
That means that 10% of just new dollars entering into the government system and then being dealt out to all the government contractors. That's why some of the wealthiest. I had Biden in my ear there. Big numbers.
Over a million, trillion, billion dollars.
Well, now I'm not going to do it.
I know where you're going for.
Took it from you. That's why the counties near in Northern Virginia are some of the wealthiest countries in America, counties, because they're the top of the spigot. They get the new money first. So the inflation effects affect them last. At least, and that's why, you know, New York, another one, a lot of pyramid debt is created out of financial sectors. That's why they feel more prosperous in many ways as well, because they're the top of the pyramid.
I think we should move the spigot to Montana. What do you say? Might be cool.
All right. Well, I think we've exhausted it, guys.
I'm not exhausted. I can keep going.
Exhaust, get it?
Hey.
Well, we are going to keep going because we got a skiff to
record. We got a skiff. Yeah, That's right. If you want to have access to our exclusive content, like the skiff, our members only show, go to humanreactionpod.com to check it out. In the meantime, we will let you go for David Rand, Kyle Mack, Bennett on the Buttons, and our special guest, Kat. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time. Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com. And remember,
there's been some disincentives for French to go both ways, France to go both ways, but obviously
that tracks.
The best way to
I was going to say that too.